Oh, hello. I'm Chris Jackson, and this is number 0461, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0461. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Phil Proctor, co-founder of the Fire Sign Theater and author of Where's My Fortune Cookie, is back to talk about a new podcast based on his book.
A friend of mine for a long time named Sue Zizza and her husband David Shin called me up one day and said, you know, Phil, we would like to release an audiobook of your story. And I said, that's wonderful. I've been looking for somebody who would understand the fact that I don't want it just to be a read narration. I want it to be something that has that Fire Sign Theater element of surprise, sound effects, music, and characterizations, and maybe even drop-ins from the albums in my long career. And she said, that's exactly what we want to do. And I said, okay, sign me up.
Donald Walters is the postmaster for the smallest post office in the United States. It's in Florida, and it's only 7 feet by 8 feet.
It is a shed, and that is originally what it was, a shed in the swamp. It has been a post office since 1953. There was originally a town here in Ochoapi. They grew tomatoes. This was the shed for the tomato farm behind the post office. The original post office burned down. The postmaster at the time, Sidney Brown, said, I need a post office. And the farm said, use our shed. And he moved into this shed, and we've outlasted the farm, we've outlasted the town, and we're still here.
Steve Long is the CEO of Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows. He also shares the history of the pillow.
Originally, pillows go way, way back, millions of years. Tree apes began building sleeping platforms, and they included wooden pillows to improve their sleep. Over time, about 7,000 years ago, only the wealthy used pillows. The number of pillows that people used back then symbolized status.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0461 was Chris Jackson, a fine musician, a voiceover specialist, and one of the hosts of the excellent radio show The Spoon alongside Robbie Rist and Tom Bowers. That show is a lot of fun. Catch it every week. Thank you very much, Chris, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Often on this show, we have stories that take place in Walmart because everything bizarre seems to happen at Walmart. But this time around, we're going to shake things up. Today's story comes to you via Target, or for you in the bourgeois set, Target. A man was arrested for walking around a Target store with his genitals exposed. 21-year-old Richard Kuhn of Florida told police that he was in the store with some friends when they offered to give him $20 if he exposes himself. Kuhn decided to take the challenge and exposed himself to at least three women, who then reported him to store employees. The employees at the Target store found Kuhn and held him down until police arrived. The first woman told police that she was in the home decorating section when she noticed the man with his genitals exposed next to her. A second woman said she was in the food section when she turned around and saw a man exposing himself. Wow, in the food section. That could be a sanitary issue, especially around the cold cuts. A third woman was near the women's clothing area when he approached and exposed himself there. All three women gave the officer a similar description of the suspect. The story doesn't say which part of the suspect was being described. Kuhn was arrested on a misdemeanor charge of indecent exposure. It was not reported whether Kuhn was just double-dared or double-dog-dared. Either way, $20 is $20. I'm sure it won't pay his bail or fine, but he did win a bet, and after all, it's the principle of it all, isn't it? Isn't it? Yeah. A man suspected of assaulting someone with an axe and then swimming through MacArthur Park Lake in Los Angeles to avoid police was taken into custody. The situation unfolded around 2 p.m. when authorities say a man armed with an axe threatened someone and then assaulted them with it. That suspect then swam to a small island in the middle of MacArthur Park Lake, refusing to leave. Eventually, the man got into the water and swam around for a while before he came back to shore. Firefighters hosed off the man before he was taken into custody. The victim, who was attacked, is expected to survive. No one knows if the suspect left a cake out in the rain. After arresting a drunk driver, Jackson County, Oregon sheriff's deputies were waiting for a tow truck to haul away the car when another man jumped in and drove away. The officers gave pursuit, chasing the car through several towns, crashing through fences, running over spike strips, and driving the wrong way down roads. Police say the driver tried to hit a patrol car, then ran from the vehicle. Police caught 23-year-old Anthony Clark as he was allegedly trying to steal another car. They say Clark told them that he had taken LSD and thought he was playing a real-life version of Grand Theft Auto's video game. He faces a list of charges including driving under the influence of intoxicants, criminal mischief, escape, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, attempting to elude a police officer, possession of a stolen motor vehicle, unlawful entry into a motor vehicle, interfering with a police officer, reckless endangering, reckless driving, and offensive littering. Wow. Well, all that should get him a high score, huh? And also a high bail. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Meanwhile, police in Daytona Beach, Florida, tried to pull over a car themselves for a minor traffic infraction. The driver didn't care to stop. Instead, he sped off with an officer in pursuit, going 60 miles an hour in a 25-mile-per-hour zone and running a red light, which resulted in him broadsiding a car that had a green light. The miscreant's car careened off a light pole and into the front of a barbershop, but that wasn't the end. The driver jumped out and ran. Now, despite his head start, officers caught up with him because his loose-fitting pants fell to his ankles, tripping him.
Pants on the ground, pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground. Go in your mouth, head turned sideways, pan hit the ground, call yourself a cool cat.
Officers charged 24-year-old Tobias Smith with driving with a suspended license, and the plate on his car was taken from a different car. He was jailed on a litany of charges. You know, yet another young guy who should be belted.
Pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Phil Proctor, the co-founder of the legendary surrealist comedy group The Fire Sign Theater, is back on the program. We spoke to him last fall when he released his autobiography called Where's My Fortune Cookie? My Psychic Surrealistic Story. Well, Phil is back to bring us up to date on other projects that he's doing. He's on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Phil.
Hi, and I knew you were going to say that, Peter. See, it's just another affirmation of the extraordinary psychic nature of my life and existence. And you're part of it. I'm so happy that you are.
I'm glad you're happy to be back on the program. You know, the last time we spoke, we talked about your book, and now your book has gone into the podcast world. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, you can actually connect up with a 30-segment series of my podcast if you go to podbean.com. It's the Proctor Podcast at podbean.com. And the way that this came about, Peter, was basically a friend of mine for a long time named Sue Zizza and her husband David Shin called me up one day and said, you know, Phil, we would like to release an audiobook of your story. And I said, that's wonderful. I've been looking for somebody who would understand, you know, the fact that I don't want it just to be a read narration. I want it to be something that has that Fire Sign Theater element of surprise, sound effects, music, and characterizations, and maybe even drop-ins from the albums in my long career. And she said, that's exactly what we want to do. And I said, okay, sign me up. So I flew into Brooklyn, where they live and where they have a wonderful little studio, a little basement studio, the best kind. You know, you've been in the radio business for a while, so you know that when you're doing radio stations, they're either they're either in the basement or they're in the penthouse, right?
Yeah.
Because those are the places where you get the least noise that will create problems. So anyway, I went down in there, and over a period of 3 days or so, I recorded my book in my own voice and with my own corrections, because I discovered as I was reading the manuscript that there were a couple of factual errors that got by the copywriters. So I've had a rare opportunity to update the book, if you will. So when you listen to it, that's as pure as it can be at this particular time in our world.
Did you have an opportunity to bring in those copywriters on your show to find out what was the source of the errors of their ways?
Well, you know, what we actually did was I sent the first copy of the book, the printer's copy or whatever you call it, out to my friends and relatives and said, you know, read through it and tell me what you find, that you know, you find any errors in grammar, punctuation, or factuality, and let me know. And that helped a lot. And we cleaned it up as best we could. But you're a writer, and I'm sure you understand that when you reach a certain point with a project, especially a book that's going to get out there for people who know you and who want to read your work, you have to, at a certain point, you have to just say, okay, this is it. It's going out, right? Otherwise, you can spend really the rest of your life correcting it, right, and trying to make it perfect. It was Orson Welles who said, the death of art is the lack of limitation.
And also, right? As you say, when you write a book, not only do you have to put it out there and stop correcting it, but after a while, you yourself as the writer no longer see any mistakes that might be there.
Yes, that's true, of course. Absolutely true. Now, what was interesting was my wife, Melinda Peterson, and I just came back from the Here Now Festival that Sue and David are very, very involved in Kansas City, Missouri, okay? And we premiered launched the podcast from a wonderful theater there, the Cinemark Theater, on Friday afternoon. And we were able to listen to the show, me for the first time, along with the audience, in this wonderful theater environment with great sound system and everything. And I was very pleased and tickled at what Sue and David had added to the story. Because, as you may remember, the book starts off with a bang when I relate the story of how I survived the Golden Dragon Massacre at the Chinese restaurant up in San Francisco in 1977 with my touring partner from the Fireside Theater, Peter Bergman, and how that was psychically predicted by a friend of mine named Sharon like 2 months before it happened. Okay,
wow.
Now that gives anybody who hasn't read the book or who doesn't know my story a little tease as to what you're going to get if you purchase it at Amazon.com or tune into the podcast at Podbean.com.
Now, the podcast, it's 24 episodes. How long is each episode?
Oh, they vary, which is the wonderful thing, as you know, about podcasting. So I think the first one is like 14 minutes, and I did not strictly follow the rigors of the chapters because I wanted to tell this story again from my own personal perspective. And so Sue and David and I agreed on breaking it in certain points. So some of them will be maybe 10 minutes, some of them will be longer, but it should be an organic experience, and wherever you pick up on it, it will, one chapter will lead, I hope, excitedly the other. We also have a friend named Tom Kelly, who is a podcaster in his own right, a younger voice, who introduces each story and gives a little tease for the next one to come, so that there's a contemporary feeling to the whole event.
I got to ask you, I mean, for those who remember the Firesign Theater and the type of work you did, which was hysterical, it was very surreal, but we weren't necessarily at that time living in surreal times. What would be different about the Firesign Theater if it were out today? Would it be harder for you?
That's a smart question. and I'm going to give you a stupid answer. Right now, as we talk, although this show will be played a little later, we have two dictators who are meeting under the table in Sing Sing, and one of them has three names like you, Peter Anthony, and the other un is bent on undoing every progressive American law since FDR, who also had three names. So I ask you surrealistically, coincidence? I don't think so. You see, the satirist like me, God help me, sees things through a distorted lens, if you will. And my job, which I accepted, is basically to try to express a perspective on things that will make people laugh at them instead of being fearful of them. Because we have no control over the events that are unfolding around us, or our society, or our political environment. But we can look at it from a perspective of strength. And that perspective of strength means we can change things if we go into the voting booth. We can change things if we speak on public media about how we really feel in order to attract other people or excite other people to go into the voting booth and change things if they want to do so. And it's the satirist who makes you kind of liberated because he's making fun of these things. We are, in a sense, the court jester. Okay, it is an honored profession, and I embraced it at an early age, and I'm still proud to be one of the members who promotes it in my entire life. Okay, and we have been rewarded, the Firesign Theater, because the Library of Congress recently purchased our archives for $500,000. Okay,
wow.
And my other surviving partner from the Firesign Theater, which was, for those who don't know it, four wonderfully funny, inventive men, David Osman, me, Phil Austin, and Peter Bergman. And Phil Austin and Peter Bergman are no longer with us. They're making God laugh. And David and I have created a piece called The Art of Radio, which we performed at the Coolidge Theater at the Library of Congress when we learned that they were purchasing our archives. And also we were celebrating the fact that they brought one of our records, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, into the historical recordings at the library, which was the beginning of their quest to honor us by acquiring our archives. And so we are now, David and I, we just performed it at the Here Now Festival in Kansas City, The Art of Radio, which is a mishmash of earlier Firesign Theater stuff and new observations about the world as it continues to evolve. And it looks like we might be touring that piece. And who knows, maybe we'll catch up with you sometime in person if we're performing in your area.
In your area.
Excellent. Now, I've got just about a minute, but I got to ask you this question. You talked about the album that is going into the Library of Congress, and it brings up an interesting point, and that is we live in such a politically correct world these days. Are there some things that you can't do in comedy that you used to do?
Yes, of course. When we, as part of the new Art of Radio presentation, David and I excised a whole piece from a thing we called the American Pageant, which was done back in, 1967, something like that, really early in the late 60s. I was once early in my late 60s, but those days are gone, too. And it was a piece where we're singing a song that basically uses every bad word about every ethnic minority in order to illustrate that everybody has been disparaged over the course of the history of our crazy nation. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I said, no, David, we just can't do this. There are too many words that would just make people's heads blow up right now. too many sensitive names. So we didn't do it. Now, if you want to follow my career, you can go to planetproctor.com. And if you want to find out who the Firesign Theater is, you can go to firesigntheater.com and learn more about us. Because we started in radio and listener-supported radio, which was equivalent to, I guess, the podcast today, right?
Right.
And basically, we are still on the air online. At Firesign Radio, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all of our radio shows and albums, played in constant continuity. No, in continuity, one could say. And so you can get a taste of this. And if it's something that inspires you or that you find funny or interesting or daring, because even though we did our stuff over a 50-year period, so much of it is pertinent now because we were futuristic writers. And I'll leave you with one last example of that. One of our fans was a guy named Steve Jobs, a young man who was starting to investigate the idea of maybe becoming interested in computers. We did an album called I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus, in which I play a hacker named Clem who plants a virus in a government computer and brings down this whole future fair. This was in 1977.
Wow.
Steve Jobs heard this, was inspired by it, and if you talk to Siri and you say this, this is what you'll hear. Hold on. I'm going to try it now. Here. Come on, Siri. Come on. Come on, Cole. Come on, girl. Come on, girl. Come on up here. This is Worker speaking. Hello.
Hello, Auckland. What function can I perform for you? LOL.
Okay. I'm Clem. That was the name of my character. When I told the computer my name, I said, Clem. So I became a Clem to the computer. And you notice that Siri is using a computer voice and then says lots of laughs afterwards. That's Steve Jobs honoring the Firesign Theater. I met him in person, besides the fact that he came to a record signing that we did in Berkeley in 1971. But I met him later when I did voices for the Pixar movie A Bug's Life, and he said to me he was a big fan. So I'm honored. We are very honored, not only by the Library of Congress, but by Steve Jobs for expressing his love of the Firesign Theater.
You can hear stuff like this all the time if you listen to the podcast. The podcast is the Proctor Podcast .podbean.com. Phil, it's a pleasure to have you on the program again. Thank you for being here with us.
Always, always a pleasure to talk to you. You're a bright, shining star in the podcast universe.
Phil Proctor, co-founder of the Firesign Theater and the author of Where's My Fortune Cookie? My Psychic Serialistic Story. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0461, and you'll find links to Phil's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You'll also find links to where you can find the new podcast version of his book as well, which is theproctorpodcast.podbean.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the postmaster from the smallest post office in the entire United States. We'll also learn about the history of pillows and some interesting pillows that a company makes called Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. Plus, we have much more Stuff File news here on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. After calls of a reckless driver on Interstate 75 near Punta Gorda, Florida, Charlotte County Sheriff's deputies found the car driving 40 miles an hour in a 70-mile-per-hour zone. Yeah, you heard right, 40 miles an hour in a 70-mile-per-hour zone and swerving all over the road. After pulling the car over, the driver, 34-year-old Brandon Aaron, allegedly told them, "Sorry, I was rolling a joint." A search of his car found a felony amount of marijuana, meth, opioids, and various other drugs and paraphernalia. Aaron was arrested. Hey, at least cut him some slack and give him a little credit. He was only rolling a joint while driving. It's not like he was texting. Yeah. A man managed to record a video of the moment a young woman got her head stuck in a tailpipe of a truck. The video shows rescue workers trying to free the woman from the tailpipe of a red pickup truck. Billy Little posted the video on Facebook with the caption, "How much alcohol does it take to get your head stuck in a diesel pickup exhaust tip?" After the video went viral, the woman came forward and shared her side of the story. 19-year-old Caitlin Strom said that she was at the Winstock Music Festival in Minnesota where she drank alcohol. She explained that she was having fun with her friends when she spotted the big exhaust pipe and thought, "My head could probably fit into that." Yeah, that sounds like alcohol, all right. Her head did go in, but it became stuck and she wasn't able to get out. Firefighters cut the tailpipe, and after 45 minutes, she was finally freed. She immediately apologized to the owner of the truck, Tom Wald, who she did not know. The man told her he was glad she was okay. According to Strom, the truck owner did not ask her to pay for the damages because, quote, "he was so absolutely wonderful." Yeah. However, the police were not so forgiving. The McLeod County Sheriff's Office cited the 19-year-old woman with underage drinking. The now famous sawed-off tailpipe is now on display in a bar. I'm going out on a limb to say that when she's of legal age, Caitlin will probably be drinking for free at that bar. I'm also guessing that in some circles, her dating life has improved greatly. Three men were arrested on May 20th after stealing a 25-foot shed from a foreclosed property in Lebanon, Maine, and dragging it, yes, dragging it, down the street behind their pickup truck. Matthew Thompson of Lebanon, Timothy James of Pembroke, New Hampshire, and Robert Breton of Milton, New Hampshire, were spotted in the act by a concerned citizen who alerted Maine State Police. In addition, Thompson was found to have crystal meth and prescription drugs that were not prescribed to him. All three were taken to the York County Jail and held on $5,000 bail. Wow, dragging a 25-foot shed down the road behind a pickup. No, that isn't going to cause any suspicion, is it? Oh, it might cause some sparks, but suspicion? Nah. Who's going to notice a 25-foot shed blocking the street? Everyday occurrence, right? Uh-huh. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, we've had similar stories to this next one on several occasions, but I have to start off by saying that firefighters are, for the most part, brave, honorable souls who do their best to help those in need when a blaze breaks out and never break the law. Now that I've said that, let's get to 18-year-old Patrick Gillis. He's a senior at Highlands High School and a volunteer firefighter for the Pioneer Hose Fire Department in Brackenridge, Pennsylvania. Gillis told police he just wanted to respond to a fire on May 21st when he was arrested for starting a blaze in a vacant duplex where he used to live. Witnesses told investigators Gillis was seen at the home before the fire started, then returned as a firefighter to help put it out. He admitted to setting a piece of paper on fire and putting it in the microwave, then leaving. The Allegheny County Fire Marshal's office estimated the damage at $150,000, and Gillis was charged with arson. Well, he's going to be going to prison now, so he won't be able to burn so much as toast. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? If you're visiting the state of Florida, one of the sites you might want to check out is the Ochoapi Post Office. The 7-by-8-foot building has the distinct designation of being the smallest post office in the United States. Joining us now is Donald Walters, who is the postmaster of the Ochoapi Post Office. Hi, Donald.
Hey, how are you doing, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So, 7-by-8-foot building. That's one tiny office you have.
Yes, it is a shed, and that is originally what it was, a shed in the swamp.
How long has this been a post office?
It has been a post office since 1953. There was originally a town here in Ochoapi. They grew tomatoes. This was the shed for the tomato farm behind the post office. The original post office burned down, and the postmaster at the time, Sidney Brown, said, I need a post office. And the farm said, use our shed. And he moved into this shed, and we've outlasted the farm. We've outlasted the town, and we're still here.
Now, when that fire took place, was it always thought to be that the shed, which is now the post office, would have been a temporary situation until another post office was built? Or was it always known to be that this is it, that's what you get?
I think they said, that's it, and this is what you're going to get. And it's just remained that way since 1953.
Okay, so again, I said 7 by 8 foot. I guess it won't take too long. Can you describe what it's like to work inside this post office?
It is literally, if you think of the office worker cubicle, that is about what it is. It literally, I have a computer on one side, a desk on the other, and maybe two people could fit in here between the aisleway.
How busy?
Very small.
How busy are you?
I am very busy. We get people from all over the world here. It's amazing how many people actually show up here. It's one of the great things about this job that keeps it very, very fresh. I meet people from Asia. I meet people from Europe. I've had to learn a little bit of German just working here. We get so many Germans walking through here. It's great. It's amazing. It keeps it very interesting to meet people from all over the world, especially folks from Canada.
You told us when it became a post office, you say, back in 1953. So obviously you know the history. Do you know a little bit of the history of when it became popular, when it started to grow in popularity, when it became known as the smallest post office in the United States and therefore someplace people wanted to check out?
I would say probably in the 60s when this area started really picking up with people. I mean, South Florida, back before the 60s and 70s, was sort of a desolate place. A lot of people, they came here just for the wintertime to escape the snow up north. But as more and more people have moved here since the 60s and 70s and 80s and on, this became a bit of a roadside attraction until they built 75, which is the main highway leading from Naples, Florida to Miami here in the south.
And speaking of main highway, how far are you, if at all, off the beaten path? Are you on the or near the main highway?
I am on 41, which used to be the main highway. It used to be the main road you take from Tampa to Miami. That's hence the name Tamiami Trail, which is the street I'm on. US 41 is the designation. But the main road now, the main highway is Highway 75, which literally stretches, I believe, all the way from Memphis, Tennessee to Miami. I'm about 10 miles from that, so I'm a little bit off the beaten path, but not too much if you want to take the scenic route down through the Everglades, which is beautiful, if you're willing to come this far.
Now, what's the closest building or structure near you?
There's actually a lady that lives across the street from me. So that's probably the nearest building, literally right across the street. Then probably about half a mile, there's a restaurant, Joni's Blue Crab Cafe. It's world famous, and she's open on weekends.
Working in a building that is this small, I mean, I'm guessing it doesn't have any facilities. When you got to go, where do you go?
I have to shut the door and put a sign on the door and go about 5 miles down the street, down the road to the nearest gas station.
Wow.
I have to close up. It's about a 20-minute round trip too.
That's dedication. So again, you say you're pretty busy. What are the hours that you're open as a post office? Is it general post office hours?
We are open from 8 to 10, and then for 2 hours I remain open for 2 hours. But usually, if I have to, that's when I have to run down the road to do other things or do paperwork in the post office. So we might be closed between 10 and 12. But then we're open from 12 to 4 every day, except for Saturday. Saturday is from 8 to 11:30.
You do say you're busy, but I'm sure there might be some lulls. In a building that small, do you ever get lonely, or is it a bit of a solitude to work in a place this tiny and you're one of the only employees?
No, usually people are showing up every 5-10 minutes. There's a new person here, so it doesn't really get too lonely, but there are lulls that do happen. I tend to read a lot and, you know, or just finish up my paperwork that I can't get done during the day. The post office tends to keep me a little busy, so.
And when people come to you, are they aware of the fact that it's the smallest post office in the world, or do you have people who just come across you looking for a post office and realize, wow, there's something uniquely tiny about this place?
It really depends. It seems to that the Europeans tend to know that this is here, that it's a small post office. It seems to be a very big thing for them. It's in their traveler's guides and traveler's magazines. Usually people, believe it or not, that live in the area, like either Miami or Naples, that for some reason are coming across the U.S. 41, they're surprised to see it here, and then they're usually the ones that are surprised that something so small's out here.
Yeah, people never really know what's happening in their own backyard. That happens no matter where you go. Again, describe a little bit what's inside. I mean, you've got a desk, I would assume, a computer, or I guess you need air conditioning. What can you fit in this post office besides yourself?
Not very much. If I have a lot of parcels, because we do deliver mail out of here, and they have to stay outside. And during the rainy season, we put an umbrella over them, or we cover them with a tarp so they don't get wet, because they just won't fit in here. Very, very little fits in this post office.
Well, what's it like being inside there yourself during the rainy season?
It's not too bad. Like I said, that's usually when most people don't show up. That's the solitude part you were talking about earlier. At that point, we just wait for people to show up and hopefully, you know, read and make phone calls, do our paperwork, do the postal work that needs to be done when people aren't around.
And when the weather is nice, is it a situation where you can keep the doors open and at least get some fresh air, or does it get hot and stuffy in there? I know you have an air conditioner, but can it get hot and stuffy in there?
It does. It does. In the summertime, it is very hot, especially around July and August and September. That's the hot months here. Usually the rainy time also, it'll rain cats and dogs every day. Wintertime, you don't even need the AC on. It's beautiful here in South Florida. You just open the door and the breeze comes in, and it's wonderful.
Do people come by specifically to get a postmark from the smallest post office in the United States? And is there something or anything unique about your postmark that states that?
There is. I have actually two. I have the official United States Postal Service postmark, which has the date and our address and our name on it. And then I have another postmark that basically says I'm the smallest post office in the USA. And I put those on everybody's postcards and letters as they come in, and they give them. And yes, many people come just asking just for that.
How long have you been the postmaster there?
I have been the postmaster here since November.
Oh, so you're recent.
I am recent. I've been here about 6 months. The lady before me was here for 13 years, and usually that's how it shakes out. People come here, and they're usually here for a long time.
Are you from the area, or were you aware of this particular post office before you had the job?
I was aware of it. I've been with the post office for 20 years. I worked in Naples. That's where I grew up at. I've lived there since I was two, and I don't really remember living anywhere else. I'm as close to the Naples you can get without being born here. We moved here in 1976. Hmm. So I've been in Naples, Florida, since 1976, which is about 30 miles from here.
What do your friends and family say when they say, Donald, I understand you work at the smallest post office in the United States. What's that like?
Oh, they love it. They think it's great. And then, you know, my mom, she loves going on to Facebook, and she'll type in the Ochoapi post office, and she sees pictures of the place, and I'm in about half a dozen of them as people put them up on their pages. And I'm sure if you go to Twitter or Instagram or anything else like that, I'm sure I'm on there too.
Now, I had to go through the officials at the Postal Service to have a chance to talk to you, as is the case with anybody who wants to talk to a member of the U.S. Postal Service. But I'm just curious to know, people are coming in from all over the world, as you say. What about people like myself, people who just want to talk to the guy who works at the smallest post office in the United States? Are you getting a lot of press?
I do get press. Since I've been here in November, this would be my third interview. And I know the lady that worked here before me, she had been in numerous, a few television spots, a few articles in the Wall Street Journal. And so we do get interviewed quite a bit, actually, yeah. People are interested because it's a unique thing, you know. It's one of those unique things that people want to know about.
That would be Shannon Mitchell, by the way. She's the one who worked there for 13 years?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And did she retire or go to a bigger post office or what?
No, she works. She is actually working out of Everglades City and Chokoloskee, down just a little bit on the other side of us.
Well, it sounds like you have.
She isn't retired from the post office.
It sounds like you have a unique job in a unique location, and it also sounds like you've got the best of all worlds. There's a little bit of solitude, but you get a lot of people. You draw attention because it's a bit of a tourist attraction, but not too much so. You seem to have the Goldilocks of situations, even though it's the tiniest post office in the United States.
No, this place is amazing, and it's fantastic. It's very photogenic, and so that keeps people coming here. And the people that come here want to be here, and they're happy to be here, and that in itself makes it very rewarding.
Donald, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate you calling us and letting us let the world know that we're here, so that they can come down and visit us.
Donald Walters, the postmaster of the Ochoapi Post Office. If you need more information, you can check out the Postal Service's website at usps.com. And if you go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0461, you'll find that link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. For a lot of kids, opening a lemonade stand will be their first money-making venture. For parents, it's a fun way to introduce kids to how the free market works. Unfortunately, for many families, it's also become an introduction to how government bureaucracy works. In May, officials in Denver, Colorado shut down a lemonade stand being run by children because they didn't have a city license. Government crackdowns on kids selling lemonade in Texas, Florida, and other states have also been reported. Let's be fair, do we really need to strong-arm kids who open lemonade stands? Of course we don't. Utah recently passed a law protecting minors who operate lemonade stands, and other states should follow their lead. Until they do, kids have another option. The company that produces Country Time Lemonade has created a fund that will help pay fines and permits for kids who want to run their own lemonade stands. The name of the fund is Legal Aid, spelled Legal, A-D-E, just like the drink. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about pillows. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. We also have more Stuff File news stories here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, the city of Lake Worth, Florida, sent out an emergency message to cell phones in the city at 1:45 a.m. Power outage and zombie alert for residents of Lake Worth and Terminus, it warned. And 7,380 customers were involved in the blackout due to extreme zombie activity. Ben Kerr, Lake Worth's public information officer, said there is an investigation ongoing as to how the message got into their emergency notification system and apologized for any alarm. I want to reiterate that Lake Worth does not have any zombie activity currently, he said. Okay, is it just me or are you just a little bit concerned about Ben's statement? I mean, let me repeat it. I want to reiterate that Lake Worth does not have any zombie activity currently. Do you see my concern? Was it really necessary for him to officially add the word currently? Does he know something we all don't? Ew. Meanwhile, 25-year-old Sidney Bouvier Gilstrap Portley, yes, that's his real full name, was arrested on May the 11th in Dallas after scamming his way into two Dallas high schools in an apparent effort to relive his basketball career. Gilstrap Portley was charged with posing as a 17-year-old student and Hurricane Harvey evacuee so that he could play high school basketball. As Dallas schools welcomed students displaced by the hurricane, Gilstrap Portley first enrolled at Skyline High School and then at Hillcrest High School, where he was a star on the team and dated a 14-year-old girl. In fact, high school coaches voted him Offensive Player of the Year. The Dallas Morning News reported that a former coach spotted him at a tournament and alerted Hillcrest's coach that he had graduated, quote, a time ago. Wow. 25 years old, pretending to be 17, and dating a 14-year-old. Now, he really is the offensive player of the year. Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Can you believe that the first pillows were made of bronze, wood, porcelain, or stone, or that their original purpose was to keep bugs out of your ears, mouth, and nose? Those are just some of the facts that pillow expert Steve Long, the pillow guy, knows. He's the CEO of Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows, and he's on the line right now from Arizona. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Peter. How are you today?
Just tickety-boo. Thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. I got to say right off the bat that I'm enamored with the name of your company only because this show is called the Stuff File Program, and we spell stuff S-T-U-P-H. You spell Famous Folks with P-H's as well. And I've always explained why I do it. Why is your company called Famous Folks with P-H's?
Peter, we originally started off back in 1991 under the name Pillow Ball, and it transformed to Funky Ball with a PH, and then Funky Ball transformed into Famous Folks, and we kept the PHs.
Yeah. I use PH a lot because they happen to be my initials, so there you go.
I like it.
It's as simple as that. Now, not only are you in the pillow business, but you, as I mentioned, you are an expert. You know the pillow history. In the introduction, I mentioned the fact that pillows were made out of bronze, wood, and porcelain or stone back in the day. And I'm thinking, that couldn't feel good. But when you learn the original reason of the pillow, maybe that makes more sense. So give us a little bit about the pillow history.
Well, originally, Peter, pillows go way, way back, millions of years. Tree apes began building sleeping platforms, and they included wooden pillows to improve their sleep. Over time, about 7,000 years ago, only the wealthy used pillows. And pillows symbolize the number of pillows that people used back then. Symbolize status. So the more pillows one person owned, the more affluence they owned, and progressed during the 11th dynasty, dating back to in Egypt, dating back to 2000 BC or so. And back then, ancient Egyptian pillows were wooden or stone headrests. And these pillows were mostly used by placing them under the heads of the deceased because the head of a human, a live human, was considered to be the essence of life, therefore sacred. And the Romans and Greeks of ancient Europe mastered the creation of the softer pillow made out of reeds, feathers, straw in order to make them softer and more comfortable. And again, at that time, only upper-class people typically owned these softer pillows. However, all classes of people back then were allowed to use some type of pillow while sleeping, lying down, or sitting in order to give them support.
And when did pillows become something that was more for the masses and not just for the rich or upper class?
Well, in my opinion, that started happening, Peter, back in the 1600s, 1700s, when pillow manufacturers were able to determine how to make pillows not only softer, but affordable to the masses.
And that's the important thing, softer. So what were those first pillows made out of? I'm assuming they were made out of some sort of feathers, but do we know what kind?
Well, it's my understanding that goose feathers were used. Primarily, might have been chicken feathers as well, and possibly some kind of animal hair as well.
I'm wondering if anybody, because usually if you're making a pillow, you want something soft, and straw can be soft, it can be prickly, but did anybody ever make pillows out of straws, you know, by stuffing them in a case and using that?
To my knowledge, yes.
Yes, so they did do that.
Yes.
Interesting. So let's flash forward to Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows. You make pillows. How did you get into this business? And what is special about the pillows your company has to offer?
Peter, good question. I was a huge fan of the old Pink Panther, the Peter Sellers Pink Panther movies. And one in particular, made in 1976, was The Pink Panther Strikes Again. And at the beginning of it, Chief Inspector Dreyfus was in the insane asylum, the psychiatric ward, and he was talking with his psychiatrist. And over in the corner, in the background, was a Chief Inspector Clouseau dummy doll. And I looked at it, and I took a picture of it, and I thought to myself, I have to have one. So my mother was quite a seamstress back then, and she and I made one. I still have it. Dressed it up to look like Peter Sellers, or at least the what I'll call the dummy doll in the movie. And that got me thinking about how could we make pillows that of people or images of people that would make you think that that person was actually sitting there. And one thing led to another, which led to another. And the next thing you know, we applied for a patent. We came up with a pattern, applied for a patent, obtained the patent. And that's what we're doing today. Very much want to get into making limited edition celebrity pillows that we can sell or auction with a portion of the proceeds going to charity. We have produced a lot of celebrity pillows that we've donated over the years. And of course, we want to get into the high-end retail stores as well. So that's kind of the brief history of Famous Folks.
And we should mention, people can take a look at the website, which is famousfolks.com. And again, it's PHPH for Famous and Folks. There's some remarkable pillows that people can see there. They really have to be seen to be believed. But since you brought up the movie The Pink Panther and movies in general, you know a thing or two about pillow fights in movies and also pillow fights in real life.
Well, I've been in a few.
which one? Pillow fights or movies?
More the pillow fights than the movies.
Okay.
Oh, that's funny. two pillow fights in particular immediately come to mind. One in a movie and one with a... an internationally famous band called the Beatles.
Oh, right.
And
yes.
In 1964, a photographer by the name of Harry Benson was in Paris at the George V Hotel, and he had been assigned to photograph the Beatles, and he didn't want to do it. He said, I took myself as a serious journalist, and I didn't want to cover a rock and roll story. But he went ahead and met with them, and he said once he met the boys and heard them play, he had no desire to leave. He ended up taking a picture of a pillow fight of the Beatles, and as it turns out, that pillow, the photo of the pillow fight, was taken the same night the band found out that I Want to Hold Your Hand hit number one in the U.S. And the photographer, Harry Benson, said that was perhaps their last moment of unbridled innocence. So so that's one that comes to mind. The other iconic pillow fight comes from the movie Animal House. And I'm sure we've all seen that,
the
scene where John Belushi climbs up the ladder to the second story window of the sorority house to watch the sorority girls in a pillow fight, and that look when he turns and looks at the camera like, oh my word. I've never forgotten that scene.
Well, you mentioned the Beatles and hotels, which brings me to another question. In hotels, they put chocolates on pillows. Do we know where this comes from?
Yes, Peter, we do. And that tradition didn't start all that long ago. Apparently, in the early 1950s, the actor Cary Grant was staying at the luxurious Mayfair Hotel in downtown St. Louis. At that time, he was a frequent guest, and he booked the penthouse suite, and he had a woman who was meeting him there. As the story goes, as I understand it, the woman arrived at the suite before Cary Grant did and found that he had laid a trail of chocolates across the sitting room, into the bedroom, across the bed, and onto the pillow. The Mayfair's manager heard about it, and he liked the idea so much that he made chocolate on a pillow standard in the Mayfair.
Fascinating stuff. We've got just about a minute, so I want to get back to your pillows for a second. The company is called Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows. You certainly know your pillows. Do you have international sales? Is this something that has gone worldwide with your pillow company, or is it just something that's in America for now?
Well, it's in America for now, but we certainly could ship internationally and would love to do so, and would love for everybody to take a look at our website, www.famousfolks.com.
And we should mention again, Famous Folks is spelled PH. For both Famous and for Folks. It's a great site. It's a great site, and there are great pillows. And I thank you very much, Steve, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Steve Long, the CEO of Famous Folks Furniture Art Pillows. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0461, and you'll find links to Steve's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A bank robbery in Anchorage, Alaska was solved quickly and easily. The robber presented a holdup demand note written on the back of an affordable housing form with his name and birth date entered in the appropriate spots. Officers hardly needed that to link him to the crime, however. According to an FBI spokeswoman, it's my understanding he was sitting outside the bank counting his money when police arrived. Michael Gale Nash was charged and later confessed to the crime. By the way, if he had finished counting, he would have known that he got away with $400. Well, he was looking for affordable housing. Now that will be provided to him by the state. Because why? Oh, why? Would you write a bank robbery note on the back of a form that has all of your vital information on it? And more importantly, why would you sit outside of the bank you just robbed to count the loot? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of The Stuff File program number 0461. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0461. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.